This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Highway 17 is a major link for eastern North Carolina. It connects military bases, the port, and other economic engines of the region. Improving the flow of traffic along Highway 17 from Jacksonville to New Bern has been a priority for the Department of Transportation for many years, and finally progress is being made in fulfilling that goal. Executive Director of the Highway 17 Association, Mark Finlayson, says road projects planned for Jones County have been approved and will break ground in 2015.
DOT calls it the R-2514 project. That's their STIP designation, State Transportation Improvement Program. It is the same project that we've been dealing with one way or another for decades, literally.
Finlayson says the project has been delayed again and again due to potential impacts to historic properties, wildlife species, and the environment.
So all those things had to be taken into account and eventually were resolved, perhaps taking longer than they would otherwise.
In August, NCDOT appropriated the final $56 million to fully fund the project. The plan involves the construction of two bypasses around the towns of Maysville and Pollocksville and the widening of the stretch of existing highway between the two communities. Finlayson says the entire 12 to 14 mile projects will start simultaneously.
At the Board of Transportation meeting, the board approved an acceleration of the contract letting for the project so that it will take place in June of 2015. And all three of the segments, the Pollocksville bypass, the stretch in between, and the Maysville bypass, will be let together.
When the project is completed, the entire Highway 17 corridor south of New Bern to the South Carolina state line will be four lanes. Mayor of Pollocksville Jay Bender believes the $225 million project will have a positive economic impact on the small town.
The pros are obviously a great reduction in the amount of traffic through our little town, which has become a real safety issue. The other pro that I see that comes from the bypass is going to be a significant economic boost in the area just outside the current town limits. The major intersection for the bypass through Jones County will be at the intersection of 58 and New 17. That's where the beach traffic comes from. Pollocksville will even actually get two stoplights out of the deal.
Mayor Bender says several companies have already contacted him with interest in setting up new businesses in the town. He believes an existing industrial area just north of Pollocksville will see benefit from the road projects too.
This will be an easy access for these folks to get on and off a major highway, and it will make them more efficient, it will make them grow, and it will make our area grow.
While Bender is optimistic, some aren't so happy with the plan. I traveled to Maysville on Thursday where I spoke to a dozen residents. It was mixed reaction, with some welcoming the new highway and others opposed to it. Ian Dine is a store manager for Piggly Wiggly in Maysville. He says they'll take a hit, especially during the summer months.
We'll miss out on a lot of the beach traffic during the summer. Probably picks up after Memorial Day and runs through about Labor Day. You know, people stop in and they have timeshares at Emerald Isle. We'll stop in, you know, get a week's worth of groceries or so, and that helps us out during the summer. Well, I just hope it doesn't turn this into the town that time forgot. I'd like to see the town grow and the community grow and not isolate themselves.
Town manager Jonathan Franklin agrees some of the local businesses will take a hit, but he says the bypass will give Maysville the chance to reclaim its main street.
With the traffic that goes through now, it's not safe. It's not pedestrian friendly for people who walk. Once we can get a majority of that traffic going around or going through the bypass, we can really focus on making downtown Maysville, or, you know, Main Street, you know, usable, make it walkable, make it stroller friendly, and really start to, transform Main Street into what typically you would think of a Main Street in a small town like Maysville is.
Franklin says he's glad to hear the Department of Transportation will be widening a dangerous section of Highway 17.
As far as safety goes, between Pollocksville and Maysville, you have like one of the highest numbers of extrications, meaning the fire department rescuing people in car accidents. So we're also looking forward to getting that four-lane road through here to make the route a lot safer than what it is now.
The highway improvement doesn't come without a cost. Brian Yamamoto is the head of the Department of Transportation's Eastern Project Development and Environmental Analysis Branch. He says about 50 people will be displaced as a result of the widening project.
In addition to the
properties that are completely taken, there are going to be some people that are just losing pieces of the property. So we do have right-of-way appraisers that go out and appraise the damages to those pieces of property, and then you enter into the negotiation process with our right-of-way section.
Yamamoto says construction will start in 2015 and could be completed as early as 2018. To see a map of the R-2514 bypass through Onslow and Jones counties, go to our website, publicradioeast.org, and click on this story. For Public Radio East, I'm Jared Brumbaugh.
This year, stories from the NPR archives that touch on the meaning of Christmas, our hopes, and our fears. David Sedaris, Bailey White, Scott Simon, these and other voices of NPR past and present telling stories of the season in an hour-long Christmas special. I'm Lynn Neary. Join me for Tinsel Tales from NPR.
Christmas Eve at 6 p.m. on PRE Public Radio East, News and Ideas.
The Downeast Journal is made possible by our Public Radio East members in partnership with Warden Smith PA, a full-service law firm with specialized practice groups in real estate, agribusiness, elder law, and more. Warden Smith, dedicated to the practice of law. Information online at wardensmith.com. Handel's Messiah. It's a Christmastime tradition celebrated around the world. Next week, the Craven Messiah Chorus will have their 31st annual performance in downtown New Bern. Public Radio East is a media sponsor for the event, which takes place Monday, December 16th. An open rehearsal will be held at 3, followed by a 7 p.m. performance. I spoke with President and Co-Director of the Craven Messiah Chorus, Pat Rowlett, about what people can expect at this year's event.
For the open rehearsal, they can expect to see the orchestra coming in and seeing the music for the first time. Not the Messiah, but the ornaments that Jim Ogle will write into the score for them with pencils. And so they will see them work through that, and they'll see all of the arias that the soloists will sing and all of the choruses. And in between pieces, Mr. Ogle will make adjustments for tempos and things like that that need to be fixed. And then for the performance, they'll see a seamless rendition of part one and parts of part two and three of Handel's Messiah.
The performance is actually going to be in Centenary United Methodist Church in downtown New Bern, a very beautiful and historic venue.
Well, this particular church is where we have always held the Messiah. We like it because it is sort of in a fan shape, and the front of the church has plenty of room for our orchestra of 19 or 20 players and 114 singers in two choir lofts and on risers and all spilling out into this center or area of the church. There are no other venues in New Bern that have room for that many singers, so we're excited about it. And they've just put some new flooring in the chancel area so that we're expecting the acoustics to be even better than usual. And then they have beautiful stained glass windows. So especially in the afternoon, you're seeing this gorgeous, these works of art. They sort of make the light in there very special.
Now, what would you say to someone trying to choose between going to the open rehearsal or the regular performance?
If you haven't been before, the rehearsal is a great way to learn about the putting together of this particular work. And plus, it's a little more informal, and there's applause allowed between the numbers, which, you know, a lot of people like to act like an audience and you know, go crazy when they hear something they really like.
I think it's important to mention, too, that the members of the Craven Messiah Chorus are actually from Eastern North Carolina, and that some people actually drive quite a distance to be a part of this.
One drives all the way from Wilmington. He has sung every year. And then a lady from Goldsboro drives all that way. And then we have people from Moorhead and Pamlico County and Swansboro. And just it seems like they're all over the place, just come to sing this music again and again. And that really speaks for the music itself and for the text and the meaning behind it. So it's a real special thing for the time of Christmas to hear this music and to perform it.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I heard you say that some of the chorus members have been with Messiah Chorus since the very beginning. Is that right?
We have about five or six singers in the chorus who have been there every year. And then myself and Betty Jo Oglesby as directors, we've been involved from the beginning. And so has Cindy Sutton, who is our accompanist. And then Jim Ogle has been there every year. And one member of the orchestra, he has been our concertmaster until just recently, Paul Gorski, has played every year.
How many people do you expect to attend this year?
We can seat a little over 400 in the sanctuary. And the open rehearsal will usually have between 200 and 300. So it's a lot of people.
This is a ticketed event. Tickets are being sold at Fuller's Music and the Craven Arts Council. If you'd like more information on the Craven Messiah Chorus performance next week, visit our website, publicradioeast.org. Pat, good luck this year, and thanks so much.
All right, bye-bye.
If you can't make it to a live performance this holiday season, hear Messiah from Washington National Cathedral at 7 p.m. on Public Radio East Classical at 89.3 on Christmas Eve. For a complete list of holiday programs, go to publicradioeast.org.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. Many of us who love gardens and being outdoors find we also love birds. Well, there's the spectacular ones, of course. I've seen quite a few eagles this year in eastern North Carolina. And where I am, I'm lucky enough to hear osprey calling, and I have a couple of hawks that regularly skim over the marsh. There's not a lot we can do to draw those types of birds to our yard, but we can draw other birds, migratory birds, songbirds, just by how we set up our gardens, where we put things, and what we choose. If you'd like to have birds frequenting your garden and yard, what are the key things you should do? Well, think about the fact that there's two things they really need. They need a safe place to hide, and they need food to eat. Those are the things you want to provide. We have a lot of vines in North Carolina, including trumpet vine and Virginia creeper, honeysuckle, wild grapes. All of them provide both shelter and food for birds. So think about incorporating them, maybe on a trellis or somewhere on the edge of your garden. A number of other plants that do well here: beautyberry, viburnum, wax myrtles, all sorts of fruiting, nandina and pyracantha and autumn olive, as well as hollies. They do beautifully here in eastern North Carolina, and all of them provide excellent food for birds. Think about having some trees that keep their leaves throughout the winter. Live oak, red cedar, cypress, all types of evergreens provide necessary shelter during the cold winter months. You can increase diversity with magnolias, and looking now to the deciduous trees, persimmons, river birch, even flowering dogwoods. All of those are great for birds. And if your yard is large enough so that it can be done safely, consider leaving an old dead tree standing. Quite a few birds nest in or utilize dead trees left in the landscape. It's so much easier to provide natural shelter and food for birds than to try and build bird houses and keep bird feeders clean and filled and the squirrels at bay. So this winter, while you're cozy in your house, think about how you can make your yard a better house for the birds you'd like to see. We have so many spectacular birds that come through this part of North Carolina. It would be a shame to miss them. Do some armchair landscaping over the colder months so that when spring comes, you're ready to plant and draw birds to your yard for years to come. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
Last week, during our Sweet Treat series, we shared a special pulment recipe with you. This week, it's all about chocolate. Gene Heath, chef and owner of the White Oak River Bistro, explains how to prepare a seasonal favorite, the Yule Log.
I've been making Yule Logs for many years, and it's just kind of an accumulation of different recipes. They're all pretty much the same, though. Essentially, you're making a jelly roll. The Yule Log is traditional. It's supposed to look like a log, and so I like to do the chocolate ganache on it, and the pecans make it look like tree bark on the log.
Is this something that you serve on your holiday table?
We do. We do it quite often for Christmas parties, and we do it for family get-togethers at the holiday season.
Now, the Yule Log is a chocolate lover's dream. There's chocolate in the center, and once it's all rolled up, chocolate ganache is spread over the outside of it. What are the steps that are involved in putting the Yule Log together?
You make a basic sponge cake and then top it with the chocolate ganache and with nuts and coconut, and then it's rolled up and put in the refrigerator until it all comes together, and then coated with the more chocolate, and then you can use a comb effect on it and give it the texture of bark on the outside.
Gotcha. Now, on a scale of 1 to 5, what would you say the difficulty level for putting this Yule Log together?
I'd say the difficulty on this would be about a 3, maybe a 4. It's a pretty simple cake. It just takes time to assemble and put together.
There's the part where you have to roll the cake up. I imagine that would kind of be the hard part, right?
That would be the hard part. But once you get the parchment paper to start working for you, you can roll it right up.
Are there any tricks that you found that kind of help out? Does it need to be warm, or does it help to be cold? Or
I think it's better if it's room temperature. It's pretty much the safe way. Too cold, and it's going to get a little crumbly. Too warm, and it's going to pull apart as well. So
I think the great thing about this particular recipe is that most of the ingredients, you know, can be found in our cupboards and our pantries. We already have them.
Sure, they're absolutely they're just staples that we all have in our cupboards, and makes it easy to assemble. You don't have to go run around trying to find special ingredients.
And, of course, the holidays are a great time to spend with your family. And what a better place than in the kitchen making this recipe?
Involve your children with it if you have children or grandchildren, and they'll have a great time doing it. And when you cut it, slice for the dessert, they'll be amazed at how beautiful it turned out.
I'm sure they will. Gene Heath is the chef and the owner of White Oak River Bistro. Hey, thanks for speaking with us, and have a happy holidays.
You do the same, Garrett. Thank you.
Mr. Heath's family recipe for the Yule Log is posted at our website, publicradioeast.org. With the holiday season soon underway, you know that many meals will be shared. When people eat, they talk, and given enough talk, they'll tell you about what they eat. That's the concept behind Amy Rogers' collections of stories and recipes entitled Hungry for Home, Stories of Food from Across the Carolinas. George Olson spoke with the Charlotte resident and has this, which originally aired in May of 2004.
It's pretty easy to thumb through Hungry for Home and say cookbook, period, and you wouldn't be wrong. There are over 200 recipes in the book from over 100 contributors, including some from noted authors like Jill McCorkle and Jerry Bledsoe, but primarily from non-professional chefs that Amy Rogers calls home cooks. Whether from writers or non-writers, virtually all the recipes come with a story, some which only vaguely have some tie to the recipe itself, but all with some type of emotional tie to the end product. That can seem somewhat surprising when you're talking about a biscuit recipe, but Rogers thoroughly expected that type of conviction.
Just because we live in a region where there hasn't always been an abundance of food throughout the ages past doesn't mean that there's been a scarcity of tradition and culture. I think the fact that Carolinas are so rich with an oral tradition of storytelling really is shown through these recipes, because a recipe is something that can be just orally passed down, it can be written down, it becomes incorporated in who we are. I encountered so many people who had recipes that they prepared for generations past, and those were the stories that I enjoyed the most.
Some of the stories don't even really involve food, such as this tale Amy Rogers wrote about peach farmer and author Dory Sanders, highlighting the ability of rural Southerners to take next to nothing and stretch it into something.
The peaches did not survive the early cold spring of 1997. What would Sanders do when the customers began arriving in June, looking for those wonderful peaches to put in pies, cobblers, and homemade ice cream? That was the summer Dory Sanders sold rocks. Not just any old rocks, but 100% genuine farm rocks, each with its own certificate of authenticity. She sold them to kids, and she sold them to grown-ups. She carefully washed the peach-sized hunks of rosy quartz, polished them up to look pretty, set them out on the farm stand tables, and when people stopped by to ask what she was doing, she told them, "We don't have any peaches today, but we do have farm rocks that you can take home with you."
For Rogers, Dory Sanders is perhaps the epitome of the home cooks who contributed recipes and their related stories, talented, resourceful, and equal parts ready to share or talk about food.
Well, I think it's interesting because the Carolinas are such a place of great storytellers that it only makes sense that we would also be great storytellers when it comes to food. Dory Sanders, the wonderful author and peach farmer, is fond of saying, "If it weren't for food and who died, we wouldn't have anything to talk about."
Having to talk about food is one of the reasons the job description for cookbook author has to be among life's more pleasant, though it probably doesn't outweigh the fact a cookbook author has to be a willing sampler of much food. That was the case for Rogers in putting together Hungry for Home. She says of the 200-plus recipes in the book, she attempted to make or at least sampled almost all of them. Rogers says as a journalist, she often uses food to explore a region's culture. It was recipes she decided not to taste test that said the most about the South, where we are contrasted to where we've been.
Some of the traditions, which are at least a generation or two removed from our daily lives, are the ones that still kind of make me think twice about who we are and how far we've come. We do have recipes for snapping turtle, and we do have recipes for possum. And I confess to not having tried those, although Doris Davis, who submitted them to us, has done them, and she recognizes that that was not that long ago the way some people ate routinely. So that's a tradition that's very important to recognize here. I don't attempt to supersede her ability to cook a possum, I will tell you that.
Even if she had the will to supersede someone else's ability to cook a possum, she might not have the touch. If there's one thing Rogers has learned in talking with and observing the home cooks who contributed to Hungry for Home, it's that intangibles are everything.
I think there's something in every recipe that's a bit intuitive, even if it's spelled out as clearly as you can imagine. I think every cook has his or her own touch, but the best cooks are not typically the ones who do measure.
That is the case with Virginia Jackson, whose buttermilk biscuit recipe appears midway through the book. The recipe involves a grand total of 3 ingredients, which leads one to think, how hard can it be? Hard? No. Able to successfully replicate? Perhaps not. In an essay accompanying Jackson's recipe, Rogers speculates why.
Virginia can't remember all the contests she's won, but she never forgets the key to making perfect biscuits. She advises this: keep your mind on what you're doing, don't just throw them together, and forget using a mixer or even a spoon. Virginia mixes every batch with her hands. It seems so simple, 3 ingredients. So there must be a secret, something that makes one biscuit or cake or pie or bread different and special. If that something doesn't come from the store or out of a book, where does it come from? Can it be measured like so much flour and shortening? In Virginia Jackson's strong brown hands lies at least part of the secret. When your hands have worked the fields, tamed a garden, and cared for children, almost anything is possible. Virginia's touch is unique. A talent like hers can be learned, but it comes only by doing, with care and with practice. And learning takes time, an investment too few are willing to make. But there's something else still, something that comes from the heart. I went to Virginia Jackson's house back in 1994, I think it was, because I had found out through my own research that she was the Blue Ribbon biscuit baker for all of North Carolina. She had won the Blue Ribbon at the State Fair. So I called up Ms. Jackson, and she very kindly allowed me to come to her house and watch her make biscuits. And I felt like I was in the presence of true magic. I watched what she was doing. She wrote down the recipe. I took the recipe home with me, and then I sat down to do those biscuits, and they were pretty good, but they were not as good as hers. Not because I did anything wrong, but because, as I say in the story, your hands learn almost kind of without your mind telling them when something is right. And that only comes with time and practice.
Amy Rogers is the author of Hungry for Home, Stories of Food from Across the Carolinas, which is published by John F. Blair. I'm George Olson.